This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents 20th Century Boy, Notebooks of the 70s. This is the author, Duncan Hanna. For Megan, and to all those friends gone, and friends still here. Blazing our nights with arguments uproarious, what care we for a dull old world censorious, when each is sure he'll fashion something glorious? John Reed, 42 Washington Square. Preface. This is not a memoir. These are journals begun in 1970, at the age of 17, written as it happened, filled with youthful indiscretions. They've occupied a couple of shelves in my library for the past 40 years. I think I initially kept a journal because I didn't like the feeling of time slipping through my fingers, and this was a way of arresting it. Writing was a way of self-mythologizing, so I could get a grasp on who I and my friends might be. I read a lot and wanted to emulate what I was reading. I was under the spell of Kerouac. The early journals were filled with a lot of stream-of-consciousness writing, which I have edited out. Terrible mumbo-jumbo, exacerbated by the drugs I was taking. I'm fortunate I jotted down a lot of dialogue and bits of detail, because these would have left my memory. Anyhow, it's all as I saw it. The books themselves are black-bound, unlined, sized 8.5 by 11 inches, purchased at art supply stores. I named each one, there are 20, and did a proper DIY title page. They acted as scrapbooks as well, which was a family tradition. Even my grandparents were avid scrapbook keepers. My rapidograph script is wedged in between pasted clippings of my current favorite rock stars, movie stars, nudes, candy wrappers, tickets, and general flotsam my magpie nature retrieved from the dustbin. I wasn't yet a collagist, but had an eye for paper ephemera. I started pasting with Elmer's glue, then switched to rubber cement, which smelled nice, but discolored the clippings and lost its adhesive qualities after a few years. I eventually settled on spray fixatives, which are highly toxic, yet were perfect for my needs. There were black and white photos of me and my friends sprinkled throughout. These journals start when I was a junior at a public high school. I'd been expelled from the private boys' school, Blake, I'd attended for 5 years, for selling LSD under duress to a tubby student who used to play keyboards in the Atlantic Queen, a garage band we were both once in. He freaked out and ratted on me. As it turned out, it was a good thing I got thrown out, as I was flunking French, Latin, history, science, and geometry. We were doing E equals MC squared in 10th grade, for Christ's sakes. I excelled only at English and art, hated the compulsory sports. My dad had been valedictorian of that same school, skipping a couple of grades before entering Harvard at 16. I wasn't exactly following in his footsteps. He was a dapper corporate lawyer, think James Mason, and had been on mood stabilizer since the year I was born to combat depression. He always wished he'd stayed in the Navy. He had a good war, skippering a subchaser in the Solomon Islands, rescuing Australian coast watchers from Japanese-occupied islands, doing cleanup after Guadalcanal. Plus, he was on a destroyer moored next to the Missouri during the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay. Now there was evening martinis, wine with dinner, sometimes a scotch and soda after dinner, pills to wake up, pills to go to sleep. He said the secret to happiness was distraction. He belonged to an old men's club in downtown Minneapolis, covered in ivy, where he played squash. I liked to read Sherlock Holmes in their big burgundy leather armchairs. We belonged to a beautiful country club just outside the city, where he played tennis with his lawyer buddies. I liked the kidney-shaped swimming pool overlooking Lake Calhoun, listening to my transistor radio, eating fudgesicles. My mother was a great beauty in her youth, still was, a bit like Maureen O'Sullivan, Tarzan's Jane. She was always stylishly dressed and loved parties. She worked as an interior decorator. My parents used her income to travel to Europe several times a year. They would pore over travel magazines and timetables, plotting trips. When I began to go wrong, my mother seemed to take it personally and would unleash her anger. She could never hold her liquor, whereas my dad could. Dad usually took the long view that my generation was being profoundly affected by the ongoing turmoil in the USA. He took the high road. My sister was 5.5 years older. She was a great achiever, voted peppiest by her high school. She left to go to Mount Holyoke, marched with Martin Luther King. My parents had been strict with her, but they gave up when it got around to me. I didn't have a virginity to protect. The end of the 60s hit me dead on. I started smoking cigarettes at 14, pot at 15, then came the rest. LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, hashish, opium, dexedrine, crystal meth, booze. I lost my virginity while still in boys' school to an apple-cheeked suburban cheerleader with whom I had nothing in common other than raging hormones. The ritual took place in the back of a small speedboat, docked in a marina on Lake Minnetonka, smelling of canvas, vinyl, and gasoline. She had me pull out periodically when she thought I was getting too excited, terrified of getting pregnant. She wouldn't let me use a rubber, said they were dirty. What I was interested in was rock and roll music, pop art, girly magazines, and dirty books. I learned the facts of life from two paperbacks, Strumpet's Jungle and Pay for Playgirl. Drugs, my weirdo friends, movies, and books, mostly coming-of-age stuff, like Salinger and the Beats. Also the pulp reissues of Doc Savage and Fu Manchu. I was a drummer in various bands and an artist. I did impatient, jittery drawings that combined all my interests. I was always the class artist for which I was given special attention. I had a fresh face which I inherited from my mom. I assumed I was headed for great things, and indeed, I had a lot of lucky breaks over the years. I was eager to move to New York and join in the fray. The title, 20th Century Boy, taken from the T-Rex song of that name, seemed fitting. I am truly a product of the second half of the 20th century. For all its faults, the 70s in New York City were a great time to come of age. There was no money, so that wasn't a concern. Living in Manhattan was cheap, and one could lead an interesting existence on $400 a month. There was no internet, so one did one's research in a more hands-on way. I suspect the results meant more to us because they were hard won. The 70s had a rear-view undercurrent of interest in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, which jibed with my sensibility. Our quest for authenticity and experience led us in colorful directions. We had faith in the journey, even if we were unsure of the destination. I had never read these journals before transcribing them. In preparing them for publication, I removed a lot of extraneous detritus. I didn't do a lot of navel gazing, as many diarists do, so I didn't have that to contend with. I noticed, at the time, that mostly it was girls who kept journals, and they generally wrote only when they were upset. I was determined not to do this. I tended to write from jubilation. I wrote these at night in bed, if I was in any kind of shape to write. or in the morning over coffee. I didn't write every day, and as life accelerated, I would miss notating chunks of experience. Indeed, 1979 hardly gets a look in at all. I don't know why. I've changed some of the names to protect the innocent, and also the not-so-innocent. The grammar and spelling have also been corrected, as my slipshod grasp of English composition leaves something to be desired. It struck me, as I waded through these journals, that this was a very long time ago, totally different from today's climate. Strange to view this rake's progress through a contemporary lens. The sexual landscape was different then, wide open. It seemed a new frontier. It was a weird feeling to reconnect with my youthful self, who I was often amused by and often ashamed of. But such is the nature of youth. I felt a sympathy for my parents and sister Holly that I selfishly didn't have at the time. I felt sympathy for me as well in the throes of nascent alcoholism that I didn't then understand. I saw the arc of addiction going from bad to worse. I saw myself trying to keep up with it all, from becoming the artist I wanted to becoming the man I wanted to be. I was scrabbling for a foothold in the contemporary culture on my own terms. Miraculously, most of what I'd yearned for on page one had come true on the last page when I was 28. I think only then did I begin to grow up. Of course, a lot of it was fun and funny, but a lot of it was harrowing, too. It could have ended up very differently had I not had a guardian angel watching over me. What would I change? A futile question. It is what it is. No regrets. New York City, February, 2017. Mystic Eyes. Winter of 1970. I think back in the private boys' school I went to. They tried to break me, those bastards. They whacked me with oak boards and gave me noogies. My homosexual Latin teacher twisted my ear around because my conjugation lacked something. I had lead ashtrays pitched at my head. I was shoved into a gym locker and hammered upon. I came on to mescaline in French class. I wrote hundreds of sentences beginning with, "I will not." I wheezed during soccer practice. It was crushing me. Now I'm free. Adrift in a huge public high school where very little is demanded of me. I just got done jamming with my band, the Hurricane Boys. We did Boris the Spider, Run, 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 Communication Breakdown, I'm So Glad, I'm a Man, Stormy Weather. I felt invincible behind my set of silver sparkle Ludwigs, cutting through dense layers of Gibson guitars, leading, following, patterns lock in, my head spins, and a rush swoops up from my toes to my crossed eyes. Sounds great, and it's coming from us. Driving back home past nighttime neon suburbia, Tom Thumb, the Little General, Nate's Food Market, Snuffy's Drive-In, Smack's Hamburgers, Quick Mart, Dairy Queen, Pee-wee's Big Fish, the A&W, the Seven High, Hart's Cafe, listening to Clapton on the radio. The car full of crazy long hairs, a working unit, one feeding off of the other, observing, pretending, babbling, goofing. We're on our way to somewhere, picking up, dropping off. I think of 15-year-old Honey Sullivan. Last December, she got shipped back to her mother's house in Dixie County, Missouri. She was only here a few months after some trouble back home. Honey had been one of those precocious kids who would be the only girl in an all-boy club and do a striptease for them in the treehouse. Never had a dad. She was hot to trot. She'd been shown the ropes by some pool shark drug dealer, 10 years her senior, for one entire summer. Our first kiss was in Loring Park. After smoking a joint and watching the ducks, we rolled around by the flower beds, all tongues and suction. We break for air, and she says in her southern accent, "I knew you'd kiss like that." I thought to myself, "I never kissed like that in my life." We made out till midnight. She said, "Next week I want to make love to you." I remember her big eyes looking up at me in the school hallways as she grinned and said, "Hello, boy. Hungry for the nights of passion to come." She's 2 years younger than me, but much more sexually advanced. I remember her back as she undid her white brassiere and then turned to me where I lay, an indelible sight I replay over and over in my head. Perfect breast jutting out, downy soft and pink-tipped, fawn-colored fluffy pubis, arching up her limbs to me like a sensuous cat who wants to be petted and stroked. Her creamy flat stomach, her hair smelled honey-sweet, for real. Once in my parents' house, they were in Europe, listening to the Beatles' "I Want You," and she was getting all worked up. "She's so heavy," sang John. "Come on, Dunk," pleaded Honey. I was nervous that my aunt was going to drop in to water the plants or something, even though it was 8 o'clock on a school night. So we climbed the wooden stairs to the small loft over the living room, where there is a divan to fool around on. Off come my pants and boxer shorts. Off come her brown tights. On goes the chic prophylactic I stole from my dad's bathroom drawer. She presents her beautiful ass to me as she grips the banister. I position myself down between her buttocks, rake the silky slope of her thighs, enter the maiden hair. I'm nervous, thinking we don't have much time, so I'm going at it pretty fast. Honey looks back over her shoulder at me and says in that southern drawl of hers, "Hey, where's the fire?" We laughed, and I slowed down and savored just what it was we were doing. She's open to me, thrusting back, skin to skin, riding the dark waves, coming nearer and nearer, and then, in a soft, shuddering convulsion, she was gone, and so was I, melting in exquisite delight. She once passed me a note in the library, written in her kid's loopy block letters, reading, "I want a butt fuck," and I blushed and laughed, thinking, "Who does that, anyway?" But of course, she was serious, probably having tried most things with her ex-boyfriend, who is now serving time in prison for dealing drugs. I remember another time in a college kid's apartment. A bunch of older freaks were getting high listening to Abbey Road, solemnly. She knelt next to me, smoking, gently rearranging her limbs under her miniskirt every so often, playing with a cat. We crawled out of sight under the kitchen floor, where we writhed about together and French kissed, getting thoroughly excited, sexual stimulation being her favored emotional state. "I want you," she whispered. "Here? Now? What about all these people?" "We can go in the bathroom. Come on. I need you inside me." And I didn't do it. Idiot! I stood on propriety. What adult! I dropped off a very unsatisfied girl at her sister's house and drove home with blue balls. She was a nympho schoolgirl from ear to sweet southern ear. I'm haunted by her now. I dreamt she was in a production of Peter Pan. I have another recurring dream where I ride an orange school bus to a lake, and she's there. The shimmering lake is surrounded by irregular cliffs, making it dark, romantic, and spooky. She's incredibly sexy, sitting upright, an insistent little girl, waiting to be kissed and fondled. She says, "Little teapots take time." We embrace. I never, ever have sex in my dreams, sadly, so that was the end. After her, the rest don't seem right. So that's why I'm haunted. Jefferson Airplane at the Minneapolis Auditorium. Kurt and I dropped mescaline, smoked a lot of boo for the show. 10,000 freaks were there, tons of hippie babes that were beautiful, and I fell in love with them all, grinning like mad. The place was buzzing, and so was I. Everyone out of their heads for the occasion. Anticipation for San Francisco's finest. Lights go down, joints are passed. First they show a movie of the airplane at various be-ins, love-ins, and we forget what we're seeing. Is this the airplane? We laugh. Then the screen rolls up. Blue Fender amp glow, and it's the chugging intro to Volunteers. This is the airplane. Transfixed by the light show, lysergic tunnels opening up. I stood in my chair with everyone else, a sea of rocking heads. They had us. We're directing our trip with buzzsaw currents, guitar slashing, thrashing, slinging lightning bolts, improvising space music, drifting off and fading together. Feed your head, Grace wails. Total professionals guiding us through the people's music. Afterwards, when the band left and the house lights came on, we all looked at each other, minds blown, new knowledge on people's faces. We all saw the same thing, heard the same thing, felt the same thing. Unified. Strengthening our resolve to let our freak flags fly. There is a revolution. In the cold parking lot, I find my mother's blue Buick station wagon, and the gang climbs in. I reach to turn on the radio, and Kurt says, "Wait, Dunk. What if it's not the Jefferson Airplane?" I pause. "You're right." Silence. Then he says, "Go ahead, it will be." So I switch it on, and of course it is the Jefferson Airplane. What else could it be? I drive everyone home. We're all drained from the experience, the black sky of Minneapolis winter whipping past at 60 miles per hour. Someone in the back seat says, "Yay, Dunk, for staying on the road." Instantaneous applause from all the stone teenagers. May 26, 1970. Saw Roland Kirk at the Extraordinaire on Lake Street. We were the only white kids in there. He was blind and played two horns at the same time. More concerts. Rod Stewart in the Faces, the Labor Temple. Tony Williams' Lifetime with Jack Bruce, John McLaughlin, Larry Young, the Labor Temple. Traffic, Minneapolis Auditorium. The Who, ditto. The Mothers of Invention with Ainsley Dunbar and Jeff Simmons, Guthrie. Bloodwind Pig, the Depot. Likes. Robin Hood and His Merry Men. Count Felix von Luckner, the Sea Devil. Ghost Stories. Tarzan. Procol Harum. Nipples. Dracula. King Crimson. The Nice. Richard Halliburton. Flash Gordon. The Shadow. Paul Butterfield Band. Zap Comics. Larry Coryell. Laura Nero. Fu Manchu. Terry Reed. Free. Susanna York. Leroy Jones. Soft Machine. Summer Vacation. Riding on Tommy Haskell's dad's cabin cruiser on Lake Minnetonka. I lie in the prow, stoned on the good grass he got from those hoods at Excelsior Amusement Park. Endless shoreline projection, green and gray, stereo booms Hendrix on the lake, axes, bold as love. The boathouse is our HQ. Sometimes we sit in there and watch the rain, listened to the thunder. Someone brought a cute girl with wire rims and a gray velvet bikini. I loved her. She swam under my legs. It's all in a dream. In the past 3 days, my mother has discovered my roach clip, my pack of Pall Malls, a paperback entitled Drive-In Nympho. I told her I smoked dope. We really haven't talked much lately. I always have something to hide, forced into a double life. Mom said she found my sleepover pal, Tommy, in a condition that couldn't have been more zonked out. True enough, we smoke marijuana 3 to 4 times a weekday. I'm going to summer school at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. My past knowledge doesn't count for much. I'm in a new pool with a bunch of strange kids, all the best in their class. My teacher had a band in San Francisco called 50-Foot Hose. He wired the Merry Pranksters bus. He says I look like Stevie Winwood, one of my favorite English rock stars. He urges me to talk in stream of consciousness. That comes rather naturally. They're trying to teach us to express our personality in line and paint. But some of these yokels have no personality to translate. You gotta live your art. Go to where the extremes lead you. That's my credo. After school, we sometimes meet in a little secluded park in Kenwood called Seven Pools. Me and the boys sometimes call it the Palace of Piss because it's the first thing we do on arrival, unzip and perform circulars or sword fights. We can hear the symphony of a distant train coming to a halt. Screech! I'm ushering at the Guthrie Theater, the Mother's play. There's a party for them after at Sue Weill's modernist house. Flo and Eddie, backup singers, used to be in the Turtles, ask if I've got any weed. I do. So we retire to the garage to toke up. Zappa disapproves of drugs, so they gotta be careful. Back inside, harpist Tony Glover looks menacing. Spider John Kerner comes in looking dazed, bony shoulders up high. Ainsley Dunbar asked me why there's tape on my fingers. 'Cause I'm a drummer like you. We talk drums. A fellow usher tells me he flunked his draft physical by putting peanut butter up his ass and snacking on it as he stood in line. Offered some to the man in charge. 4F, baby. Been hanging around with an art school girl with the poetic name of Robin. A pre-Raphaelite from St. Paul. Kind of Greek goddessy. Almond eyes, hooded eyelids, a long, tangled mass of Medusa-like brown hair. She wears minuscule wide whale beige shorts and tight t-shirt tops. We went skinny dipping off the boathouse, both very shy. We peeked at each other. Her upper lip curls, her eyes flash all over my face. She's coy and naturally loony. She says she's afraid to get too attached to me because I might leave. We go to Lake of the Isles one summer night, lie under the trees, and finally start to initiate the heavy petting part of the deal. Five-finger shuffle. Eager, hungry, moaning, sighing, hot breath in my ear. I was messing with her peach t-shirt and the tits inside, sliding my hand into her cutoffs, where there is a multitude of hair. Now I can smell her natural fragrance on my fingers, but she keeps freaking out, saying, "What are you doing?" and bursting into screams and sobs. I try to soothe her, but she's kind of nuts. New York City trip. I flew to NYC to visit my sister, who lives above Uncle Hugo's bar in Columbus Avenue. She's working for Houghton Mifflin. Tommy's in New York City, too, staying with his beautiful blonde older sister, Ellie, who I first got high with, who always knew what was cool before we did. She reads my horoscope. She says I'm a perfectionist at lovemaking, friendly at it. I look for cleanliness and modesty in a woman, she says. Only a natural woman will do. She's into cocaine and tantric sex now with some mysterious older guru guy. Tommy and I go see Charles Mingus at Top of the Gate on Bleecker Street. Take the subway back uptown. Smoke pot in the nighttime park we've been warned against. A gang of Puerto Ricans stop in the gully below us. Danger! I put the joint out with spit. We're quiet. They're listening, looking for intruders in their domain. They sense us, smell the lingering pot, but cannot find us in the darkness. Our hearts pound. To be discovered would mean sudden death, we'd been told. They finally moved on, and we scrambled over the wall to the relative safety of Central Park West. Holly and I took the bus to Newport to visit her husband, Bars. We passed right through Harlem, and I spied Small's Paradise from the window. I love New York. Meanwhile, Tommy got robbed. I went to the Museum of Modern Art and liked Pavel Telichu's Hide and Seek, plus Kirshner's Street, Dresden. I met a fashion model named Penny, who asked where I was from. Minnesota, I replied shyly. Is that in the United States? She also asked if I was a leg or breast man. She asked if I was a writer, and I thought for a while, and said, yes. And she said, if you said no, I wouldn't have believed you. Also, an impeccably dressed 40-year-old Frenchman took me under his wing and bought me a coffee at Zum Zum. He told me about coming here with an older woman who looked up at the sausages hanging from the ceiling and said, I wish my husband had one of those. He gave me his card. They sure carry on in this city. I had a college interview at Bard today. Was picked up at the Rhinecliffe train station by a hippie on a motorcycle who told me he wasn't really a freak. I told the Bard interviewer that I tied buildings up with string, a lie. He seemed impressed. Bard was all very green and ivy-covered, perched on a cliff over the mighty Hudson. August 6th. Went to an all-day rock show at Shea Stadium. Paul Butterfield, Al Kooper, The Rascals, Janis Joplin, Johnny Winter, etc. I also went to the Fillmore East, that hallowed hall where history has been made. I loved the long-haired ushers in their green baseball jerseys. Saw Brian Auger with Julie Driscoll, and the headliners, Steppenwolf. The bass player, Nick St. Nicholas, wore bunny ears and a jockstrap, period. I was most impressed. My last night, Holly let me venture to 70th and Amsterdam Avenue, to a basement rock club called Engano's, whose ads I'd perused in the alternative press, like Cheetah, I, Cream, Crawdaddy, and Ramparts. I knew the Stooges had played there. Inside it was covered with industrial gray carpet, and the clientele was indeed fabulous. The openers, Chicken Shack, were a first-rate British blues ensemble, led by the charismatic and self-effacing Stan Webb. He of the fast fingers and foghorn voice. The headliners were the Tony Williams Lifetime, with Jack Bruce, John McLaughlin, and Larry Young. Tony sat behind his set of yellow drums and produced polyrhythms that seemed truly impossible. Each of his limbs had a mind of its own, and he sang plaintively over the top, as if it wasn't him that was creating the percussive thunder underneath. I remember reading a Downbeat interview with him, where he was asked why Miles Davis hired him when he was only 17. "Because I was that good," he replied. When asked why he left that famous quintet to form his own group when he was 24, he replied again, "Because I am that good." He is the epitome of cool. Back in Minneapolis, just heard Honey Sullivan is pregnant from her jailbird boyfriend, who's behind bars again. Only 16, just a baby herself. She wanted us to stay together, to run away on a Greyhound bus. But I knew I had a bright future in front of me, and she didn't. I dreamt of her at a train station in a green dress, green tights, and little black waitress shoes. I was amazed at her beauty, her innocent strength, her uplifted chin. I was trying to get her to look into my eyes, trying to embrace her, to keep her forever, but she was crying. August 21st. I turned 18. Mom left an article on my desk about how pot makes people reckless and your child will come home injured. When I saw it, I had a fresh fat lip from some pot-induced shenanigans. My biggest and last LSD trip ever. I bought a tab from an usher I work with. He told me it was special to take it alone in the country and to focus on positive thinking and mind over matter. I assured him I was a head, no stranger to psychedelics, having tripped over 50 times. He said this acid was made by monks on a mountaintop and would give me the third eye of awareness. Don't underestimate the power of this pill, he cautioned. So, Sunday I drive my mom's navy blue Opel wagon out to Hidden Valley, park the car, walk through the concrete tunnel to the magical bowl within. The drug was coming on real strong. Maybe that freak was right. On the crest of the cliff, I could see King Arthur and his knights galloping along, followed by two brontosauruses. I bowed my head and slipped into the depths of time / no time. All the sounds around seemed to have a new meaning. My mind unwound itself. Filters off. I could dream an elaborate dream in seconds flat. Multidimensional brain films that seemed to take hours, but only took minutes. I kept looking at my watch to try to gauge what the hell was going on. Walking through purple reeds and green shoots. I crouch. Background becomes foreground. Fractured Kathmandu. Sky hauling. Wave after wave of overheated scenarios wash over me. The answer to it all is everything is invading. Petula Clark flashes before my spiral eyes. Crickets talk about septic envelopments. Carol Lindley smiles down from a cloud. Everything is everything. Time doesn't exist. The back of my mind has shifted to the front. The duality of things. Whiz-bang! I decided I better cool it down, so sat down in a creek bed. Then I felt the heartbeat of the earth, slowly at first, then gaining. Mother Earth! She is a woman! Our beats were in sync. I started to get turned on. The sun shining down, the planet undulating beneath me. I had a full-on erection. Nothing would do but to unzip my jeans, roll over on my front, dig a little womb in the mud, and slip it in. This I did. I began to fuck the earth, and lo and behold, the earth began to fuck back, rocking this way and that. I'm taking cues from the swelling ground beneath me, enveloping me with her goodness. What? I'd never tried this before. I ground down into her welcoming core one last time and had a shuddering ejaculation. I rested in the pulsing afterglow. Then, realizing what I'd done, I pulled out and looked at my little mud cunt with the sad deposit of my pearly seed within. Looked at my scraped, dirty cock. You've gone mad, I thought. Get it together, Dunk. Then I tried to scale a cliff, using positive thinking. I can. Bad idea. I couldn't. Almost killed myself. I drifted from the bottom of the sea to the bottom of time to the bottom of pleasure. Sound turned into color, perceptions intermingling. I could taste shapes. Synesthesia. I walked up the valley slopes till the whole greenness was in front of me. There was a moving speck in the distance. It was headed toward me. It was human. It was a grubby 16-year-old pimpled farm boy with no chin and buck teeth. He wore an aquamarine t-shirt with white trim. As he ascended the hill, he eyed me with some trepidation. Here I was, badly sunburned, in a filthy white shirt, eyes as big as saucers, all by myself, in the middle of nowhere. He said, "Hey, man, what you doing?" "You don't want to know, son," I thought to myself. He sat by me and gave me some cheap, sweet wine from a jug he carried. I lit up a joint and passed it to him, and we began to talk. He was depressed because of women, he explained. He had a shaky hand, he showed me. And when girls asked him what's with his hand, he says it's 'cause he's horny for them. That wasn't going over too well with the ladies. I gave him some sage advice. I was beginning to feel a little more my old self, thanks to this cretin. We smoked another, drank some more of the putrid wine. Then I realized I had to work tonight for a Leon Russell concert at the Guthrie. I had to be there in an hour. The whole day had whizzed by. We bid our farewells, and I descended down the valley, past the creek bed I'd fucked. Pregnant now with a small planet? And into the tunnel that would lead me to my car. Could I drive? I had no depth perception and kept getting mesmerized by the least little thing. Mind over matter, that's what the man said. I began my journey from Eden into the big, bad city. I had to avoid getting transfixed by the beauty of taillights, red stoplights, green go lights, top lights, back lights, night lights. Had to remind myself that I was moving at 60 miles per hour in a current of steel and aluminum, and that it was occasionally important to slow down or even stop. Sometimes a car horn would alert me to the fact that I wasn't really obeying the traffic laws to a T. Miraculously enough, I made it to the theater. But when my co-workers caught a look at me, their jaws dropped. Was it my third eye? Had it appeared in the middle of my forehead? No, it wasn't that. It was the fact that I looked completely off my head. Dirty, sweaty, red-faced. Generally insane. My boss shook his head and just muttered the word, "Hannah." Unfortunately, I got aisle 3 that night. The biggest aisle. Which meant I had a seat 150 people. They would approach me and hold out their tickets, small bits of cardboard, colored either rose or seafoam green. These tickets had black numbers on them, which crawled like ants when you looked at them long enough, having some relation to what it was I was meant to do with them. I couldn't always comprehend what exactly. But then, mind over matter, positive thinking, I'd snap to and say, "Follow me, please," and lope, or maybe stumble, down the aisle to the correct row. I could hear the people behind me say, "What's the matter with him?" "I don't know, but it's scary. He's like a ghost." I thought, it's only me. It's only dumb old Duncan. This drug was almost impossible to maintain on. It had been 9 hours already, and I was still peaking. I'd had enough. The music was another surprise. I couldn't handle the sound of an electric guitar. It sounded like the vicious whine of a table saw in shop class, slicing right through my poor, overtaxed brain. After the show, I went by myself up to a vacant lot in Kenwood, where I smoked joint after joint of cheap weed, hoping to change the nature of my high from chemical to organic. I didn't get much sleep that night. and the next day in school I noticed a persistent feeling that someone was scratching the inside of my hollow eyeball with their fingernail. I could even hear a scritch, scritch, scritch. This unpleasant sensation lasted about 6 weeks. That was my last acid trip. So, clear my head. 5 years ago, Satisfaction was the number one song on the AM dial, blaring from every transistor radio across the country. I remember hearing its sinister tones wafting over the Minnetonka Club pool. Today I'm going apeshit over Iggy and the Stooges' new album, Funhouse. Down on the street, I'm lost in love. I can't get into the teen spirit of the Hopkins High pep rally. Purple power, youth fever, Sieg Heil! School is intended to prepare us for a life of submission. Dead, wasted energy in high school makes me sick. I put out a comic book with some other freaks that is sold in the hallways for a dime. The Daily Planet. My mom gets a call from a concerned parent who said she'd already had enough trouble with her son without this pornography inciting him to take drugs. She said countless other parents were up in arms. They were going to see that it stopped. The lady asked my mom if she knew what I was putting out. Yes, but my son is a very, very nice boy and has a great deal of artistic talent. Lady on the phone said I had to be on drugs to do the awful things to her son that I did. In a comic book? Mom's scared and shaking. Poor dear. She weakens and tells me I'm missing out on the best years of my life. But meanwhile, my art teacher, Vern, says I've got it. Just do it harder. That I'm on the verge of greatness. So, I've been making a 6-foot-tall papier-mâché sculpture of a sax player with a diving helmet on his head. Vern says I must devote myself to art, carry a sketchbook everywhere. September 20th. Jimi Hendrix OD'd in a London hotel room 2 days ago. He is dead. I remember soaring through the stratosphere with him in the headphones one night in a friend's basement on some pretty strong acid. Realized the music was made for this. Space music. Whipping through the galaxies at warp speed. You got me floating. Saw him a couple times at the auditorium. Found him a bit clownish. But he sure could play that guitar. More concerts. Savoy Brown. Poco. Johnny Winter and, with Rick Derringer. Youngbloods. Grateful Dead. Elton John. Eddie Harris. Flying Burrito Brothers. Faces, with Rod Stewart. John Sebastian, Leo Kottke, Neil Young, Al Cooper, Taj Mahal, Elvin Jones. I check in homeroom each morning before walking across the golf course, back home again. The joys of modular scheduling, which basically means I don't have to spend much time in school. I usually have the house to myself. His dad is downtown being a corporate lawyer. And Mom is off being an interior decorator. Anyhow, at 9 a.m., I sit behind Lori Gold, who's a heavy-lidded, slim Jewish girl with velvet pants and no bra. A spoiled and sultry rock chick whose dad owns a chain of food stores. She drives a Camaro and always has good hash. She's continually looking down to see if her tits are arranged right, then moistening her lips. We have sex together once in a while, but I don't see her as girlfriend material. She's got a phony way about her. She's a real snob and looks down on all these high school jocks and squares, except me. I'm the chosen one. She says she cares about me, but I'm impossible to communicate with. She says I have highly developed intuitive skills, including ESP. Why don't you come over and treat me like a whore? She whispers over my desk, then giggles. My parents are in Florida, and I've got some good weed. She's on the pill, wants to get some use out of it. It's very tempting, but I have a hard time objectifying girls that I basically don't like very much. And afterwards, I'm stuck with her. I'm often telling her that she and I don't mix. We're too different. She doesn't argue the fact, but never gives up. Says she is a silly little girl. So after spending a sleepless Friday night thinking about how there's a real, live, naked, teenage girl not 5 minutes away, I succumb to my base desires, get up early, drive over there, and ring the doorbell. She answers in a white robe that's open all the way down, heavy with sleep, slutty and pleased that her honey trap has worked. We headed straight for the living room couch, where she straddled me. Mixed emotions. Janis Joplin was found dead this morning. I got high with her and Big Brother when they played the Guthrie. Brought a couple of buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken to their dressing room. They were so skanky. The boys said, "Look, Janis, your chicken is here," all laughing at the sweet young fellow in his blue blazer and gray flannel uniform. Janice's eyes were dancing all over me, smacking her lips at the meal before her. Me! She was playing the horny chicken hawk, swinging from a bottle of Jack Daniels, making rude remarks. Nobody touched the chicken, but we stood in a circle in the cramped quarters and passed a joint around. I was trying to act cool, but the dope was so strong that I came out of some kind of time warp to see that they were all laughing at me, as if I were a choir boy they'd just corrupted. She came over and comforted me, smelling of patchouli oil, her feather boa tickling my nose. I blushed. I felt like a real hayseed. 15 minutes later, she was on stage, stamping her foot, sweating, screaming. I thought she was tragic even then. Saw her over a year later without Big Brother, liked her even less, too much angst. Gone now. Girls. Where is my loony rock and roll queen? I scour the yellow-tiled school hallways, filled with zombie vibes, looking for my soulmate. I need some more carnal knowledge. It's November. Time for indoor games. I saw performance. So I want someone like Anita Pallenberg, or Genevieve Waite, or Susanna York, or Monica Vitti. There's a girl in my theater class named Rachel who's cool, but she's got a boyfriend already. Although, once she did pull me into the dark maroon velvet folds of the stage curtain, and we made out for a minute or two. She's got a dark mane of hair and interesting eyebrows, braless tight t-shirts and hip huggers, high heel leather boots, a vixen for sure, haughty attitude. Our teacher is a wire-rimmed liberal who plays with his beard constantly, always yakking about Ionesco and the experimental theater. Us kids write a nonsense play called Cincinnati World's Fair, 1936, that came out of improv, totally stupid, but our teacher twiddles his beard and stares at us intently like it's genius. He has a great investment in being with it. He's a creep. Albert Eiler drowned this week. College entrance forms hanging over my head. Hampshire, Boston University, and Bard. I write an essay for the applications on the good and the bad in me. I write a book review of Slaughterhouse-Five. I'm writing these journals to capture my youth. When I'm 50 in an easy chair in Scotland, I can pull them out and relive my teendom. It'll be in an archaic lingo. I'd like to fulfill a dream and become a pop star, but I can't sing. Met a girl called Angie Miller who goes to Minnetonka. She's little, 98 pounds, flirty. Ran into her at some countercultural festival, and she took my hand and said, "Where do we go now, funny?" "Cute. Still a virgin. Looks like Minnie Mouse. Clucks her tongue a lot. Eats Sammy's." We go to 2001. Even better, we go to Borsalino, Marseille, 1930. Pinstripe gangsters, Belmondo and Delon. Great soundtrack. The I Ching says I will go through a lot of changes and will eventually be very successful with riches, both spiritual and otherwise. It warned me not to let that go to my head, to keep it simple. Says I always have a thing with identity. Astrologically speaking, I'm on the cusp between Leo and Virgo, with Pisces rising. My numerology number is 7, and my color is green. I don't know what any of that means. Meanwhile, my new girlfriend's passivity and virginity is wearing me down. We're at a party at Archie Cosgrove's parents' mansion. His dad is governor or something, which is weird, because Archie's like a werewolf, always so stoned, and wanting nothing more than a bowl of Rice Krispies. Angie is there, in white majorette boots, a little girl's blouse with tiny flowers all over it, a red Eisenhower jacket with a fur collar, and black corduroy pants. My imagination plays around in her pants. Angie leads me away to the bowels of the mansion, sits me down on a bay window seat, moonlight on her face, pulls me to her, all swoony-like, eager for that thing I do with her musky black patch. It's fun, but it's a one-way street. Another time at Archie's parents' horse farm, we were drinking Bacardi rum in the fancy sunken living room, and someone had an archaic stag movie that he projected onto the wall. No women, just nude men and their dicks, jouncing on bongo boards. All sorts of dicks, circumcised, uncircumcised, negroid, Caucasian, skin-tight erections culminating in a super close-up of a fly walking across the purple head of a penis, taking his time, too. A drop of semen appears, totally gross and confusing, to this group of entitled youth on the brink of manhood. We all spent the night smoking and drinking and listening to Tim Buckley. In the morning, we were still fucked up, so we talked to the horses. Listening to the new Velvet Underground LP, Loaded. Then one fine morning, she hears a New York station. She don't believe what she heard at all. Hey, not at all. Also, the Zombies' Odyssey and Oracle is fantastic. Such a rich wealth of music coming out. It's where we get our messages, our subversive directions. It's the soundtrack to our lives, the centerpiece to all this action. Ties us all together. My parents left for 11 days. Steady stream of visitors. Angie, hilarious Steve Kramer, pianist, artist, and general absurdist with dangerous tendencies, mostly to himself. Crazy feats of daring do, like climbing up a wall and hanging from the rafters upside down. And Kurt Tomitz, a shaggy beatnik informed by the Evergreen Review and Grove Press paperbacks. Miracles came to pass. Staying up for days with ganja weed, opium, champagne, angel dust, and super hash. A big New Year's Eve bash at my parents' shingled Cape Cod-style house attracts loads of freaks who needed a place to go and derange their senses. Ice cream orgy in the kitchen somehow leaves the Formica countertop burnt. Green cake frosting on the ceiling. Some group dancing makes it look like the floor just might cave in. I was in the basement as it started to rain sawdust. Uh-oh. Angie and I go outside in the freezing moonlight to see if the earth is tremoring. I had to talk some guy down from a bad LSD trip with my cosmic homilies. Kids were storing their cheap hippie wine in the snowbanks outside to chill for later consumption. Can this happen? Is it all right? my cousin Swanee asked me. "This is us," yells Kramer, having some kind of revelation. "Let the giant out!"